Welcome back to Engineering is Fun, You Should Try It, by Patrick Lettenmeyer, edited by Holly Jones, and narrated by Jack Talbot. Most of us, if given the chance, would like to leave some kind of lasting legacy to show that our lives made a difference. In the past, only a privileged few could create such legacies, but today, with tax-favored ways of giving, many more of us can participate in this adventure and experience the intense joy that comes with being able to make a difference. Would you consider leaving a gift for Gonzaga in your will? Visit gonzaga.edu/plannedgiving today. September 1943, I was a private first class at Gardner Field, still working on the flight line. On payday, the major allowed gambling in the day room, and of course, I attended. The major's right-hand man was Corporal Skidleski, Skid, from Allentown, Pennsylvania, who almost always lost his pay shooting crap, so as expected, Skid had to borrow. I occasionally lent him a 10 spot that would see him through to the next payday. That's how we became friends. One day, when I was off duty, Skid told me there was a new Army specialized training program that I was eligible for and I should see the major about it. I did, and on September 1st, 1943, I was sent to Montana State College in Bozeman, Montana, where I joined about 100 other GIs for the College Army curriculum of general engineering, with particular courses selected by the Army to last about 3.5 years. As usual, the overall Army goal was a secret. Everyone in the program had volunteered, and we all were demoted to buck private. 6 days a week, we marched to all-day classes and had 2 hours of study hall 6 days a week. We were completely segregated from the civilian students. The accommodations were bunks in a drafty barracks. The last of December rolled around, and I'd received a 3-day pass to go home, which I did by hitchhiking to and from Spokane. I spent Christmas Day with Mom and Marie at home, and then headed back to Bozeman. I returned to learn that classes were canceled. The ASTP had been canceled, and we were all to leave Montana State the next morning. It was snowing as we marched into formation down Bozeman's main street to the railway station. "Where are we going?" we asked. "It's a secret," was the reply. 3 days later, the train stopped on a siding in Camp Adair in Albany, Oregon. A major in full Army gear with a white cross on the front of his helmet and 2 GIs with M1s at their sides entered. "You are now at Camp Adair, Oregon, where you will join your new unit in the 70th Infantry Division after you have been issued new gear," the chaplain announced. "I'll be in the chapel this afternoon to punch your TS cards. Fall in." The following morning, we were individually interviewed. Mine was with a captain and a lieutenant who read my service record. "I see you were an Air Corps airplane mechanic," one said. "We have no airplanes here, and we need riflemen." I interrupted and said, "I was an airplane mechanic as a civilian, and I enlisted as an airplane mechanic. I request, sir, I be returned to the Air Corps." The captain repeated, "We don't have any airplanes. You are transferred to F Company, 275th Regiment, 70th Division, as a rifleman." It sounded like a medieval Roman army. The following 3 weeks, we spent every day at the firing range, firing or pulling targets. I fired a possible with both the Browning automatic rifle and M1 rifle. With a .45, I managed to barely hit the target's edge. The 8 men of my squad were part of about 50 quartered on the first floor of an Army barracks. One among our squad was a screw-up, prisoner of war, who had gone absent without leave. He spent his nights in the stockade and days under guard with his squad. Since I was new and low man on the totem pole, I was the screw-up's guard. I picked him up every morning along with 2 clips of ammo and a rifle. As our squad went away one day to a compass field lesson taught by the lieutenant, I had a chat with the PW. "Remember, I have 2 live clips, I said. "So, don't try anything, or you'll have 16 rounds in you." Just before we left the barracks, he asked permission to use the latrine near the barracks entry door. In he went. I sat down on someone's sack and waited for him. One of the other guys came over. "Once before, that guy climbed out the latrine window and left," he told me. I opened the latrine door and found the PW standing in front of the window. This guy is going to be a big problem, I thought. We loaded up and made our way to a grass-covered hill with a creek about 250 yards downhill where we sat down to listen to the lieutenant. A few minutes into the lecture, my prisoner asked to take a leak. "Down in front, 75 yards, no more." He got about 75 yards toward the creek when the lieutenant hollered, "Lettenmeyer, your prisoner." "I have him in range," I hollered back as I loaded a clip, leveled down my prisoner, and shouted, "Get your ass back here right now." He saw I had him in my sights and returned. What an idiot. I hated guard duty. After about 5 months of the infantry, the lieutenant told me to report to the orderly room. "The Air Corps wants you back," they said. "Pick up your orders tomorrow morning." That evening, I met my friend Sam at the beer hall. As the night wore on, all of the Air Corps ASTP joined us. "Where are we going?" we asked. "A big secret," they replied. "I'm on my way to someplace." 11. May 1944, we were on our way back to the Air Corps at Omaha, Nebraska, which was an Air Corps REPL depot. I was still low man on the totem and assigned a KP. They used coal cookstoves there, but it was the same pots and pans routine with duty hours from 0430 to the end of evening cleanup. After a week, Sam was assigned to a B-29 outfit, and I went to the B-17 outfit in Ardmore, Oklahoma. Duty hours were 12-hour shifts with a change every 2 weeks. One day, I was working on top of a hangared B-17 engine when someone on the ground hollered, "Hey, Pat!" It was Jack Murray, a Gonzaga classmate from the past. He was on the flight crew of a plane finishing final training and on its way to England. That evening, we met at the post beer hall and reviewed old times. A few days later, Jack's squadron flew away, and I never saw him again. We had a hard luck airplane, old number 401, which always seemed to have some unordinary repairs. Several times a gunner missed his mark and stitched the fin with 50 caliber holes. Those took a lot of time to patch while hanging on a tall ladder. I decided to explore Oklahoma City, so I got a 3-day pass and checked with operations. A B-17 was going there the following morning. I got up early, grabbed a chute, and went to the flight line. I had the worst luck. There sat old 401, my airplane. The pilot told me to go aft to the waist and plug in my earphones. I chucked my chute into the radio room, sent aft, and away we went. Well, almost. About 3 minutes into takeoff, a voice came through the earphones. "We've lost number 3, but we'll try to go around," it said. "I sure hope he tries hard," I thought. He did, and we landed with no trouble. But I never did see Okie City. A month or so later again, the notice on the bulletin board read with my name on the list. "The following EM will report to the Douglas Airplane Factory in Santa Monica, California." The railway station for Ardmore was in Gene Autry, Oklahoma, which was about 5 miles from the field. I made a detour to Spokane and spent a few days at home. Mom had sold all the livestock and farm buildings and had our house converted into a 3-bedroom apartment house. She took a job as the head of the Spokane County Juvenile Detention Home and was living there, but coming home on weekends. Selling the farm building solved my problems, as it forced Mom to finally give up the idea that I would be a farmer. The Douglas factory in Santa Monica was camouflaged with a massive tent of fake buildings, streets, and cars covering the real Santa Monica factory underneath. Factory school turned out to be the Air Corps C-54 Airplane Mechanics School. We finished school and were sent to the Air Transport Command Replacement Depot in Las Vegas, Nevada, but not for long. We ended up in Wilmington Air Base in Delaware. I was assigned to an engine change crew. It was the same work schedule, 12 hours a day for 7 days a week, with a shift change every 2 weeks. Washington, D.C. was a short train ride away, and my aunt and uncle lived there. I intended to see them during a shift change in a couple of weeks. A mechanic friend of mine, Bud Foster, from Palm Springs, California, knew a girl from his high school class that was working in D.C. She asked Bud to find a date for a friend of hers. Bud found me. He told me the girls had arranged a picnic for us in Rock Creek Park. My date was Bernice. She was a pretty girl with dark long hair, brown eyes, a thin build, medium height, and was nicely dressed. A missionary kid born in India, Bernice had parents that she hadn't seen for 6 years. She'd graduated from Wilson College, a girls' school in Pennsylvania. Bernice worked for the Army Signal Corps, along with 1,000 other girls, but she never told me specifically what she did. She asked me to dinner the next time I had a day off. When I did, I met her 3 roommates from Iowa. We exchanged mailing addresses and wrote each other often. I was transferred to Greensboro, North Carolina, at the Overseas Replacement Depot for the Air Transport Command. When the Japanese swallowed the first atomic bomb, we were ordered to Guam, all on the same day. We were pretty sure that the Guam thing would disappear, but we boarded a C-54 at Hamilton Field and droned on to Guam, landing the next morning to the fragrant smell of flowers and a wooden sign saying, "Eniwetok." In actuality, we were at Hickam Air Base on Oahu, Hawaii. So, we all signed our short snorter $2 bills and went to the tar paper barracks near the nose hangers. I was assigned to a crew doing C-54 50 to 200 hour checks. The weather was pleasant. I was on duty the first night, 1800 to 0600 hours, with a change to days in 2 weeks. I hoped to get a chance to check out Waikiki the next day, assuming the Honolulu celebrations calmed down. I look forward to mail call. Aloha. 12. By September 1945, the war was over, except for in some spots on Okinawa and a few small islands. My work was on the flight line and nose hangers for 12-hour days or nights, 7 days a week. We kept very busy. It took a long time to get the planes going to Japan instead of to a lot of islands, including Guam. Activity at our nose hangar was intense, with lots of traffic from the Hickam-Brisbane route. The news reported that they found General Wainwright held in prison in Japan, and he stopped briefly at a ramshackle terminal. He made a speech from the cargo door of a C-54, looking very gaunt. My friend Sam Hughes had become the crew chief of our C-47 that made a regular run for vegetables at Hilo on the Big Island. Occasionally at shift change, I could get a day off and flew with Sam to Hilo. He knew a little cafe near Black Sands Beach where you could get a great steak for 75 cents. I always worried about the small runway at Hilo that was cut out of a cane field. It was barely wide enough to handle the C-47. I eventually found Waikiki Beach. The bus ran from the main gate to Honolulu, thence to Hotel Row on Waikiki Beach. There was a nice spot on the beach up against the outdoor patio of the Royal Hawaiian Hotel with the Ala Moana Hotel next door. There were few people on the beach, with some of the beach boys surfing with their longboards. It was a lovely beach with a very long surf. Oahu was overloaded with military. Some said there were 6 million of us, and considering that the invasion of Japan was to have been in October, the streets of Honolulu were packed. A mechanic friend of mine, Elmer Luxton, discovered that the Honolulu YMCA had oyster stew dinners on Friday nights. I liked oysters too, and visited the YMCA on Friday evenings several times. A variety of planes appeared in our nose hangar. One was a four-engine passenger variation of a single-fin B-24 called the Privateer that was due for an 100-hour check requiring the engine cowls to be removed. We didn't have the tech orders for this plane and ended up pulling the propellers to get the engine cowls off. It was a big, heavy job that many years later I happened to mention to a Boeing engineer I knew. He told me he had designed the engine cowling system when he worked on the Privateer built by Consolidated Voltee during the war. We had a lengthy discussion about engine cowls. One of the guys discovered that Hickam's bachelor office quarters had a big swimming pool that was open on weekdays to enlisted men. There were several of us who spent our afternoons at the pool when on night shifts. However, all was not play. Someone put me on the list to fetch a downed C-54 on some island between Brisbane and Hickam. Three of us, myself, Lux, and a sergeant I didn't know, along with a real fuzzy-faced lieutenant in charge, were dispatched with a new R-2011 engine just out of our Hickam repair shop. The job was to find the airplane, replace the engine, and get the airplane back up to Hickam. "Where are we going?" I asked the lieutenant after takeoff. "Well, it's supposed to be Canton," he replied. "You ever been on Canton Island?" I asked the flight engineer. "I have," he said. "It's a small one with a large lagoon, one palm tree, and the permanent party lives in tents." The Japanese had left the island a long time before. The flight engineer had a chart, and I spotted Canton there in the Phoenix group. On we droned with a refueling stop at Johnson Island, and then what seemed endlessly south. Canton Island was as described: barren, with a large lagoon, a scrawny palm beside the small post office, and a large cargo ship around off the island's north shore. When we landed, a large congregation greeted the plane without any cheering. Later, I was told that every woman landing on Canton Island was cheered. It was infrequent. Tents were the accommodations, a tented mess hall with native boys garbed in cut-off mattress covers with the KPs. I was told the natives were imported from nearby Hull Island. Finally, a night's sleep, I thought. The engine had been unloaded with our gear. Sarge found a rusty tug and tow bar, and we repositioned the bum C-54 in the nose hangar. Our new engine lacked a few things, like carburetors and an oil cooker, so we removed those and had outdoor movies that night. The fresh water tasted terrible, probably because it was rain collected from the tent roof. There was no swimming because the lagoon was shark-infested, as was the water encircling the island. Some guys did swim with a posted guard with M1s on lookout for sharks. My roommate had been on the island about a year since the Japanese left. The aground ship had been thoroughly scoured for usable equipment. There was water everywhere, but not a drop to drink. We showered when it rained. The day we hung the new engine, I had a problem with exchanging the carburetor. The old carburetor had a different hole pattern than the new engine. Only 3 out of the 4 holes matched. I reviewed this with Lux and then mounted the old carburetor using 3 of the 4 bolts and a new 3-hole gasket, stuffing the empty bolt hole with a gas tank sealant. When I told the lieutenant, I also told him I had checked the life rafts, which had been pilfered of their rations and water. Hopefully, he'd handle the raft situation soon. We finally got the engine changed, the propeller and cowling mounted, and towed the plane over to the tarmac. Sarge was in the pilot seat. I sat in the cockpit seat, and Lux was on the fire bottle on the ground with the lieutenant standing nearby. Lux gave me the fire up sign that I passed on to Sarge, who fired up number 3. It started. but the propeller and engine nacelle was making a large oval rather than a circle. I hollered to Sarge, who climbed out of the pilot's seat so we could see it from the starboard window. Finally, he shut down the engine. We climbed down and went over to number 3, where everyone was in shock. "It's got a bent crankshaft," the lieutenant said. "It's actually the propeller," I whispered to Lux. When the propeller was changed from the old to the new engine, one of the blades was misaligned with the other blades by 5 degrees. It was easy to fix. We just had to reposition the blade to match the other two. So we fixed the blade and tried again. This time, the engine ran perfectly. That afternoon, the flight crew did its prescribed 1-hour slow time flight without incident. Lux and I pulled the cowling and everything looked fine. We left for Hickam right after dinner, with a load of airplane tires in the vacated fuel tank area, along with 18 GIs and a major. All were overjoyed to leave that island paradise. Droning on and on, we were mostly asleep, with the major on the floor under the engine mount. I was seated next to the doorway, leading to the cargo of tires, when suddenly, the ditching bell went off, awakening everybody. Someone was knocking and hollering to open the door, which I certainly did. The flight engineer said that the tires had shifted in flight so the door forward could only be opened from the passenger compartment. "Any reason we are losing oil out of the number 3 engine?" he asked. I went forward. "The number 3 engine is running fine, but had used almost all the oil in the 50-gallon reserve oil tank," the co-pilot told me. I knew of no reason this should be happening. "The closest land with a runway is Johnson Island, still several hours away," said the pilot. "But we'll have to feather number 3 to make Johnson." I sure hope the lieutenant had the life raft serviced, I thought, as I returned to the passenger cabin. I found the major wiping blood from his face. He'd hit his head on the stowed engine mount when the panic bell went off and had a real large bleeding head wound. It needed stitching, but no one, including the seated GIs, volunteered any first aid experience. I really needed to cut his hair from around the wound and use the sulfa pack from the first aid kit and adhesive tape to close the wound, I said, but he wasn't going to let that happen. He was intent on getting back to the States. To hell with any wound. I patched the guy up, poured sulfa on the wound. The major put his hat on without any bandage showing. "You ought to seek a medic on Johnson," I suggested. "No, I'm staying on the plane during refueling," he declared. Lux and I pulled the cow while everyone else went to find some water. The engine problem was clearly visible. The oil transfer line from the engine to the oil cooker had a loose hose clamp that allowed oil to be blown down and then outside the cowling. It was not visible from inside the plane. All we had to do was tighten the hose clamp. Once we landed at Hickam, I reminded the lieutenant about the life rafts and the plugged carburetor hole. Later, he told me the engine was going back to repair and the plane's life rafts were being replaced. I anxiously checked for mail and ran to get a beer at the new snake pit. So much for South Sea paradise. 13. I had been writing to Bernice but had no reply for a couple of weeks. Of course, I'd not recently been near any timely postal service. When I got back to Hickam, there was a letter from Barbara, Bernice's best friend. I opened it with trepidation. The gist of the letter was, "If you are ditching Bernice, it is the biggest mistake you have ever made, and you will have broken her heart." I'd hardly finished the letter when a GI told me to report to the orderly room, which I did. The Red Cross wanted to see me at their office in Honolulu, and I went with nothing but fear on my mind. When I got there, they told me to please write my mom, who hadn't heard anything from me in weeks. I promised to do that first thing. The Red Cross informed Mom that I'd been on detached service and that I'd promise I'd write. There really wasn't any excuse for not writing, since the squadron day room had writing paper. All you needed was to write "free" on the envelope in place of the stamp with your name and Army post office number as the return address before you put the letter in the drop box next to the squadron orderly room. Mail to the West Coast took about a week and 10 days to the East Coast. I wrote Mom immediately. I decided to write Bernice next, and then Barbara. I wrote the literary essay of my life to Bernice, explaining lamely that despite the war, time, and distance were keeping us apart, I loved her, and was really sorry that militarily circumstances had caused the lapse in my letters. A few days later, I composed another letter to Barbara, expressing the same thoughts as my letter to Bernice. I really had to do something about that girl. Obviously, I knew I should marry her. But how? That was a problem for another day. Instead, I went to go fix another airplane. Once I finally had my mail situation under control, Bernice told me she changed jobs and was now an Eastern Airlines passenger reservation representative and was eligible for some free flights. Maybe I can have her come to Spokane when I get settled rather than me move to the East Coast, I thought. But first, gotta get off this island. I saw Sam over a beer, and he told me he'd talked to a local island airline so he might have a job when he was discharged. Sam had been in Italy working on the bomb bay of a B-25 when someone dumped the bomb load on him, breaking his shoulder. Sam had a lot of points in his adjusted service rating score and thought his number would be called very soon. He was headed for Penn State. The Air Corps was recruiting reenlistments for 3 years, which I found interesting. They needed replacements in places like Shanghai, Manila, and Tokyo. If my discharge is delayed and I can't get back to school until September 1946, maybe I'd just stay in the Air Corps with a good steady job, I thought. 20-year retirement sounds nice. It was just a thought, and it soon faded. I wanted to go home. 14. I worked Christmas Eve, 1945, so I had Christmas Day free. I decided to spend the day lying on the beach at Waikiki, watching the Beach Boys surf. I received Christmas cards from Mom and Bernice, which I put in my pack to reread while lying in the Waikiki sand. Bernice had been most understanding about my previous lack of contact. I'd pretty well determined that it would be a miracle if I could be home soon enough to return to Gonzaga for the January 1946 winter semester, meaning I would have to find a job until the end of summer. That timing left my life with Bernice out in the great unknown. Plus, money was such a pestiferous situation. I needed a raise. The brass was continually making little speeches concerning the lack of naval transportation when everyone could see the apparently empty ships leaving through the Pearl Channel. Finally, an all-hands meeting was called at our outdoor theater. "Any questions?" asked the officer speaking at the end of his speech. "Yes, sir, I sure do," I jumped up. "What is it, soldier?" "Sir, I understand that all recruit GIs in the States are raised a rank after 1 year's service," I went on, asking. "Sir, I have a hash mark and my 3-year enlistment is over. I'm still a buck private." "Why?" "What's your name, soldier?" 3 days later, the names of several enlisted privates, including me, were listed on the bulletin board as being promoted to private first class. That brought my pay to $59.40 per month. A week later, I was on the journey home by way of the Hickam Enlisted Men's Brick Barracks, which was shaped like a U with a wide stairway leading from the first to second floor that had been riddled with gunfire by the Japanese, who'd also put a bomb in the middle of the Snake Pit Beer Hall between and near the end of the building. A few days later, after arrival, a truck took us to Camp Kamehameha, which was a tent city on the edge of the Pearl Channel. I spent a week there, watching the various ships, carriers, destroyers, and minesweepers coming and going. At last, it was our turn. All 1,500 of us, with barracks bags, boarded the APA 104 USS Westmoreland and were directed below. I immediately sensed that the preferred bunk was the top of four and grabbed the first empty one. It was a very wise idea and a beautiful January day. Everyone was on deck watching Honolulu fade into the distance when, gently at first, large waves rolled the Westmoreland to and fro. A race to the rails resulted in a very large mess with 6 GIs hanging on the rails. "Clean the rails," voiced authoritative loudspeakers. "Clear the decks for a clear sweep fore and aft." A couple of swabs with a big hose belching water very quickly cleared the deck. A large proportion of the Westmoreland's passengers were seasick. I wasn't. Late that evening, I went up on deck, found the North Star, and thought we were heading northeast into the Gulf of Alaska. "We'll freeze in these thin khakis," I thought. It was a rough passage for 8 days. A few GIs stood in long chow lines for greasy pork chops. Things had calmed down to the occasional card game, reading and sleeping. I went on deck a bit each day, even though the weather was continually stormy. A week later, I woke up to a clear deck and clear weather. Rumor had it we were landing in San Francisco the next morning. Everyone was on deck early. About 10 a.m., I spotted land. We landed in San Pedro, accompanied by a small, decorated boat with Snafu Maru painted on the side and a huge overhead boat-length sign reading, "Welcome Home." Disembarking was an emotional event for everyone. Some of the fellows ahead of me kissed the ground. "Glad to see you, good old U.S. of A.," was the common sentiment. The next day, I was on the train to Fort Lewis, and the same barracks I'd been in almost 3.5 years before. The brisk trading with war booty included Japanese and Nazi flags and German pistols. One kid was peddling a German burp pistol. I'd never seen one. I called my aunt in Tacoma and begged for a bed for the night, then hitchhiked to her home. Next morning, my uncle took me to the Tacoma train station, and by late afternoon, I was in Spokane. "Welcome home," said Mom when I called her. "There's food in the fridge, and the door is unlocked." I took the bus to Dishman and walked the last mile home with my barracks bag over my shoulder. I said a little prayer, thanking God for my safety during the big adventure, and teared up a bit. I didn't think I'd want to do that again.